I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Daisy Fancourt's daughter, Daphne, was born prematurely. While in the NICU, she contracted meningitis, putting her precarious health at serious risk. Daisy stayed by the incubator, watching and waiting, feeling helpless to save her baby. It was Christmas time, so to pass the time, she began to hum carols. She then noticed changes in Daphne's monitor every time she sang, improvements in her heart rate, her blood pressure, and oxygen levels. Singing to her daughter also had a calming effect on Daisy. Daisy Fancourt tells this story and many others in her new book, Art Cure, The Science of How the Arts Saves Lives. It's about how music and painting, dance, theater, storytelling, really anything that involves creativity, can have a beneficial impact on our mental and physical health. We know this intuitively, but now there is evidence to back it up. She joins us today on The Connection to remind us that we need the arts to live just like food. She's a professor of psychobiology and epidemiology at University College London, also director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center for Arts and Health. And Daisy Fancourt, nice to have you with us today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I put myself in your place, waiting and sitting by an incubator, watching, you know, your newborn baby struggle to live. What was that like for you to be there but not be able to hold her or even do anything that was obviously going to directly help her?
It's an experience I can barely put into words because it was like nothing I'd ever been through before. And I'm sure any other parents that have been in that situation will know that it's particularly terrifying because you're so helpless. And as a parent with a young child, your entire instinct is about how you can be supporting them and nurturing them and parenting them. And when you're in that situation, you can't do any of those things. But I think that was for me why music was so powerful, because it was really the only line I had to her at that time.
And you literally did see her monitor begin to change when you were humming these Christmas carols.
Exactly. I could sit by her side and I could see those changes happening. But I have to say that my choice to sing wasn't a naive one or just a spur of the moment. I'd been aware of the evidence base for over 10 years, having read a number of studies that had demonstrated through randomized trials that if mothers sang to their babies in intensive care units, it had these physiological benefits. So it was because I remembered these papers that I decided to sing. But nonetheless, it did slightly take me by surprise being able to see that impact so clearly in front of me.
Do you think you helped her survive? I hate to put it that way, so starkly.
One of my biggest concerns was that she was so isolated, she couldn't even have anybody touching her, was that she would feel that profound loss of connection and would give up her fight in it. And singing to her was the way that I could show her she wasn't alone, that I could give her that human connection and let her know I was still there for her. So for me, I feel like it was something that was incredibly important in her journey.
And for you as well, right? To be able to hum and also seeing the responses from the monitor, but also what it feels like when we're humming to ourselves.
Oh, I hate to imagine what was going on with my stress hormones during that period and my own blood pressure. So I was very conscious that it was not only an ordeal for her, but something where I had to be psychologically managing things as well as I could so that I was able to be there for her. So as soon as I was singing, I could see that there was that relaxation effect. It was even calming my mind. It was giving me something to do. And I could feel those own reductions in my own heart rate and blood pressure from it. So it also became something that felt like it was part of my own support system too.
Help us understand then what happens in the brain when we're either making music or listening to music. What's going on in there?
There were a huge number of things going on. I mean, it's really an activity that seems so simple, just listening to music, but actually affects so many different systems in our bodies. One of the things many people report is that feeling of relaxation. And we know that that's not just a psychological state, but because listening to music actually affects our autonomic nervous system. So the system of nerves across our body that influence our heart rate and our blood pressure. It also affects our endocrine system. So the hormones like cortisol, one of our prominent stress hormones, it helps to reduce levels of that hormone. One of the ways it does this, particularly for calming music, is because music has that regular beat. And when we listen to that beat, we tend to synchronize our brain waves and our physiological activity to that beat. So slow beats can literally help to bring down, entrain down high levels of heart rates or blood pressure. And there are also such profound effects on our brains. We see releases of neurotransmitters like dopamine that give us bursts of happiness, increases in our mood from listening.
Is there a difference between the brain of someone performing music and the brain of someone who's listening to that music?
Yes, there actually is. I mean, listening to music involves multiple different regions of the brain, including the auditory cortex, the motor cortex involved in our movements, and also regions like the hippocampus involved in memory, or the amygdala, which is involved in emotional response. But when we're making music, we're also involving lots of other parts of the brain, because we're seeing the musical score in front of us, or we're responding to the other musicians. We might be having to remember the lyrics, for example. So actually, making music is really a whole brain workout.
You describe and the use of music in hospital settings, even beyond the intensive care unit, as a way to alleviate some of the pain related to surgery. How does that work?
This is another area where there have been hundreds of research studies now showing the impact that stress has in hospital settings, particularly around surgery, because quite naturally, we can all get anxious if we're waiting for a surgery. And those high levels of anxiety aren't just an unpleasant thing to experience, but they also influence us during the surgery. It influences the amount of sedatives that we'll need. It influences the pain levels we'll feel afterwards, whether we're likely to experience delirium when we wake up from the surgery. But just listening to half an hour of recorded music prior to surgery has been shown to reduce the amount of sedatives people need, the amount of opioids they need after the surgery. In fact, some studies have now directly compared recorded music to taking anti-anxiety medication prior to surgery, and showing that actually music can have the edge, which I think is so exciting, because it's actually a more enjoyable thing to be given than just another pill whilst you're waiting for that operation.
Does it matter what kind of music you're listening to?
In those pre-surgical settings, it tends to be relaxing music that's the most beneficial because of those processes like reducing your heart rate and blood pressure. There's not actually a lot of difference between whether you choose the music yourself or whether it's one that's been selected for you. Although we do know that the kind of elevator music, which is very predictable and kind of feels like you're being manipulated to relax, can backfire in terms of its effects on us. So we need something that is real human generated music rather than that more machine-based predictive relaxing music.
I do want to move on to other arts, but I do want to focus some more on music because it feels like such a rich area to explore. How about the difference between the sort of solo experience of music, say you're singing in the car or in the shower, versus being part of a small musical group making music together? How different is that experience? How different do we experience in our brains and bodies?
Well, we can think about those experiences as having a set of shared ingredients. So each time you've still got the same music, which might be influencing your mood or your stress levels, for example. But when you're singing with other people, of course, you're bringing in that social interaction, which is really important. And one of the things that singing does very effectively is help to bond us with others. In fact, there are even some evolutionary theories that singing developed as a way of supporting group bonding. Oh. And some modern day experiments have shown that if people sing together versus exercise together or chat together, they actually bond faster with each other if they sing together. It's known as the icebreaker effect. So we're bringing in that added ingredient of the other people, which can add those extra benefits, including influencing outcomes like loneliness or social connections.
Is that measurable?
Very much so. Lots of studies have looked at social connections in terms of asking people to rate how connected they feel to those around them, but also looking at opioids and other kinds of neurotransmitters like oxytocin that are involved in group bonding. And some of these studies are suggesting that actually we're seeing these effects at a biological level as well as at a perceived psychological level.
Let me ask you about music and memory. And I think we all can recall a time when you hear a song when you were 12 years old, and here you are many decades later, and you remember everything about the song. You remember the lyrics. You remember where you were. Why is that so powerful?
Well, interestingly, the dopamine neurotransmitter that I mentioned that affects our mood also has a role in memory consolidation. So actually, the songs that have given us the strongest emotional responses when we listen to them are actually the ones that we tend to have particular memory tags on. We're more likely to remember them later. And we see this particularly in people with Alzheimer's disease. I'm sure many people may have had a relative or someone they know who's gone through that situation of no longer remembering the people around them or the facts from their lives, but still being able to sing along word perfect when a song from their childhood
Right.
comes on the radio. And the reason for this is that the particular region of the brain that's involved in long-term musical memory is one of the last to be affected by Alzheimer's. So people can still remember that music. And it's particularly the music that's had the strongest dopamine tags that is the most memorable. So often that's music people have had at things like their weddings, for example, those very emotionally charged moments, or also in teenage years when our emotions are all over the place.
And our musical memories are, is there any way to know, are they the last to go when we're dying?
They are often the ones that can be preserved very late on in that process. And we see a really important role for music and the arts more broadly in palliative care. In fact, it's interesting, all around the world, in every culture, it is actually the arts that we instinctively turn to at those moments at end of life or to grieve as well. And we see this through songs that people request towards the end of their life, as well as through poems that can get read at funerals or songs or dances that are part of that performative process of trying to understand and psychologically process those extremely challenging life events.
Is this an example of why we should bring music and other arts into the hospital, into the waiting room?
100%. I mean, the arts were intrinsically interlinked with health and healing for so much of our history. In fact, if you look at the earliest medical documents from every major medical tradition in the world, they all mention the arts. It's only really in the last couple of hundred years that we've really lost that interconnection. And it is a profound loss because modern medicine is incredible and achieves so much, but actually, it looks at part of what we're experiencing. The arts are something we can add as well that can help to consider some of the psychological and social challenges that can go alongside illness and look at us in more in a holistic way as a whole person.
And we're almost up in a break here, but it sounds like you're saying that health and the arts sort of want the same thing.
They do, and I think it's an exciting opportunity when we bring them together to actually see how they can augment what we can achieve through medicine alone.
And we're talking health and well-being, correct?
Exactly. We're talking all aspects of health, whether people have an illness or whether they're just looking to get a sense of meaning, purpose, and flourishing from their day-to-day life.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Daisy Fancourt is our guest today on The Connection. She's got a new book. It's titled Art Cure: The Science of How the Arts Saves Lives. And it's about the research and studies that have been, frankly, going on for some time now, looking into neuroscience and epidemiology and psychology and immunology and behavioral science to find that art has an incredible impact on our health and well-being. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And our guest is Daisy Fancourt. She's an award-winning scientist. And we're talking about why engaging with the arts is good for our mind and our body. She directs the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center for Arts and Health, also author of this new book called Art Cure. We spent a fair amount of time talking about music, but I do want to make sure that we talk about some of the other arts. But I think we also need to talk about what you mean by arts. What does that include?
That is quite the question, isn't it?
And it's actually because it could be everything, right?
It's really amazing how definitions can become really challenging really quickly when we're talking about the arts. In my book, I define it in terms of activities that have got these core artistic ingredients. So things like multisensory stimulation, creativity, imagination, aesthetics. The arts are particularly good at bringing these ingredients together. And we see that across performing arts activities like making music or dance or theatre. We see it across visual arts, crafts, design, architecture, literary arts like reading or writing. We see it as well in terms of visiting cultural venues and heritage sites, and even on some of those activities that aren't always instantly thought of in the arts, like horticultural arts or culinary arts, but nonetheless bring together those same creative ingredients.
So it's about making stuff, to be really down to earth here, correct?
I love that as a straightforward definition, but also looking at or enjoying things that other people have made, if we're going to augment that slightly.
And it has that all these various arts, whether we're cooking or we're singing or we're knitting or we're going to a museum, is having that same kind of effect on our brains and then, of course, the rest of us.
There are some broad effects that we actually see across all those art forms. So it's actually interesting in the literature that when we look at trials that are focused on mental health outcomes, like symptoms of anxiety or depression, we actually see that essentially all of those art forms are capable of supporting people with improvements. But there are also some outcomes where you need a particular pattern of ingredients. So for example, for outcomes that might be more mobility related, then having the ingredients of dance, your physical movement, or having a regular beat like you get in music can be particularly key. So I think that's the kind of knack here, is working out when we can do anything that's creative and when there are certain art forms that are particularly well adapted to support particular mechanisms or outcomes we're interested in.
If we're talking about an art cure, what kind of prescription are we talking about? Should we make sure that we include something creative in our everyday life?
My main recommendation is that everybody finds some creative time every day, even if that's only 15 or 20 minutes, but much in the same way we try and eat a bunch of vegetables every day, or we try and get 10,000 steps, it's important to have that creative time. But I'd say it's also valuable to try and ring fence maybe an hour a week where you could do a class or go to an event, but you're giving it longer, more specific attention. And variety is really key as well. So it's not just about loving reading, for example, that's wonderful, but that'll only give you some ingredients. It's quite solitary often, for example. Right. So trying to mix that up with other kinds of art forms that will challenge you in different ways is the best kind of recipe for this.
You talk about the role of anticipation when it comes to the arts and feeling some of the benefit of the arts. How does that work?
One of the things that people most universally report from arts engagement is that it makes them feel happy. And when we engage in the arts, it actually activates some of the core reward centers and pleasure centers in the brain, the same regions that are involved in things like food, sex, and drugs. One of the particular networks is called the dopaminergic system, which leads to the release of the neurotransmitter dopamine. And we used to think that we got these releases of dopamine making us feel happier at the kind of peak moments of arts experiences, like when the chorus comes back in a song, or you figure out who the murderer was in a detective story. But actually, we've since realized that we also get it in anticipation of those moments. It's as the suspense builds up and we know that moment is coming, or sometimes even when our expectation is thwarted and we have to wait a little bit longer. And because the arts are constantly giving us that anticipation and then that release, that tension and resolution, that's why they are particularly good at helping us to make us feel happy, because they're essentially playing on these ancient reward networks in our brain and giving us repeated doses of dopamine.
Well, when I read that, I thought of really my most favorite piece of music, which is Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. And even just saying it and thinking about it, I can feel a kind of excitement. But I want to play it for our listeners, and then we can talk a little bit about it. And this is the fight scene from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, and this is the Berlin Philharmonic. I have to tell you, Daisy, I'm sitting here rocking and rolling, but I heard the Philadelphia Orchestra play that a couple of years ago, and I thought I would jump out of my skin.
It's a glorious piece of music, and partly it is that excitement, that build-up, that sense that there are things coming. You can palpably feel the effect it has on your body and your brain when you're listening to it.
Is there a piece of music that you particularly enjoy?
I am someone who has incredibly diverse musical taste and loves everything, but I particularly enjoy pieces of music that have got unexpected rhythms in them because I find that that rhythmic complexity for me is what can give me that feeling of excitement that when you get those break beats in songs and you think the chorus is coming and then you're made to wait just that little bit longer before it finally comes back.
Well, one of the things, one of the pieces of music that you write about in the book is Beethoven's Les Adieux, talking about the kind of hidden heartbeat in this piece of music. We're just going to play just a little bit of it, and then we can talk about it. Again, that's Beethoven's Les Adieux. So, what is it, Daisy, about this piece of music that speaks to you?
I trained as a classical pianist, and in fact, I worked as a pianist before undertaking my science degrees. So it's a piece that I always enjoyed playing myself, but I also find it really fascinating because it's one of these pieces where you see that connection between music and medicine actually happening in action. Beethoven actually was, as he was going deaf, was also experiencing some heart problems. And actually, some savvy cardiologists have spotted that some of the rhythms in that piece of music and in some of his other later works actually have the rhythms of various arrhythmias
Oh my
transcribed into
gosh.
them, which would have been coming a lot more prominent to Beethoven as he was losing his sound of the outside world, but was nonetheless still being able to feel those sounds and those rhythms in his own body.
You call that, or scientists call that, entrainment, where the music and movement are coupled.
Music and movement are just naturally coupled because when we listen to music, it automatically involves motor regions in our brain. That's why even if you find a piece of music really annoying, you often find yourself tapping along to it and there's nothing you can do about it. But it's that coupling that means that we respond so deeply to rhythm in music.
Is that because we have our heart beating? That's our metronome?
We are rhythm, aren't we? We have our heart beating, we have brain waves moving in particular rates, we have our lungs as we breathe. Our body is a constant rhythm machine. So, of course, we respond very innately to rhythms around us.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Daisy Fancourt, our guest today on The Connection. And again, we're talking about her new book. It's called Art Cure: The Science of How the Arts Save Lives. Let me go back to something that you referenced earlier about even going to a museum or spending time in a place where you can look at photographs or even paintings. Some people kind of speed walk through museums, and some people, look at every nook and cranny of a painting. How important is it to pay attention?
It's actually a lot more important than we realize. There have been some wonderful studies actually in the US that looked at how long do people actually spend looking at an artwork or an exhibit in a museum. And it's about 27 seconds, which is really quite short. And actually, a lot of people will now spend that time taking photographs of it on their phones. They're giving it even less
Guilty,
attention.
guilty.
The problem with this, though, is that we're not giving ourselves enough time to actually have a meaningful encounter. Our brains respond very quickly in terms of an initial cognitive assessment or an initial emotional response. Those happen within a few seconds. But actually, if we want to have a sense of deep engagement, of building a sense of meaning, and actually have an encounter that might leave us with more lasting memories or feelings, we have to give it minutes, not seconds. And I think actually that's really changed the way that I've engaged with museums since I read that literature, because actually it's made me realize that we often feel this pressure to see everything in a museum when we go there. But it's so much better to actually decide I'm only going to look at a small proportion of the museum, but I'm going to make sure that each interaction is one that's going to be meaningful, because that's what I know will mean I've got a much stronger lasting impression of that visit.
Are you taking in the whole painting, or are you looking at each little nook and cranny in the painting itself?
It's good to do both. Actually, now I've got young children, I've been trying to sort of explain to them when you go into a gallery, like, what is it you're supposed to do? And it's really helpful to start with an initial assessment. Sometimes people will also find that reading the notes next to an artwork or looking at a kind of program can help them to have a sense of what they're looking at. It's called a schema or framework. Then we can kind of judge what we're seeing against that schema. Is it what we expect for a painting from that period, for example, or is it what we expect from that artist? And we can start by thinking about the shapes that we're seeing. Where is the eye being drawn into? What do we think the artist is trying to convey? What emotions is it provoking in us? So it's really a dialogue back and forth with that artwork.
Is it the art or is it our engagement with the art, like paying attention, being perhaps more active, getting out of our houses, that makes it a more meaningful experience?
The ingredients of getting out of the house or perhaps being around other people are certainly important in artistic encounters. And really, the arts can be a vehicle to helping us be a bit more active and a bit more sociable and a bit more cognitively engaged, which we know is good for our health. But actually, I think it's the particularly artistic ingredients that become important when we're thinking about things like meaning. And one of the things the arts are very good at is helping us to have a sense of meaning, of purpose, of flourishing in our lives. They're actually one of the activities that gives us that stronger sense of those psychological experiences. But that's therefore about having those encounters where we're giving ourselves the space to find the meaning.
Is there a difference, you think, between going to, let's say, the theater or going to a dance program and going to a sporting event? It's very public, you're with other people, you're experiencing, something kind of outside of yourself. Is the experience different? Do we take it in differently?
It's a really good question, and it's one that a couple of studies have looked at. I mean, they're both similar in that you are going to watch a spectacle in front of you with other people. So there are actually benefits from both. You can feel that sense of camaraderie with the people around you, even if it's not your friends, just being around those other people can actually reduce feelings of loneliness. But there are a couple of things that I think the arts do in a way that's particularly valuable for us. When we're engaging with arts, it can take us on a particular emotional journey that's not just the highs and lows of dealing with whether a goal was scored, but actually exploring more intricate emotions through the characters we might be seeing, for example. And this is really valuable for us because, in fact, some of the theories around why arts evolved for us as a species are about the arts actually giving us this make-believe space where we get to try out new emotions or think about new ideas or even consider how other people might be feeling, putting ourselves in their shoes as we do with characters in a play. And all of that is incredibly valuable for our brains. It's helping us to imagine how we would respond to new events in the real world. But because it's taking place in that fictional space of art, there's no risk in the same way that there would be in a new life events. And that's actually helping prepare our brains for when we do have to face new experiences.
Is that the tragedy paradox?
That is indeed what it's called. That's part of it as well. The tragedy paradox is this concept that even if we watch scary films or we listen to really sad music or we engage with shocking pieces of art, that it can still make us feel happy and we're actually drawn to those events in a way we wouldn't be in the real world. And it's about this concept that the brain needs to rehearse things. Often being able to rehearse how to manage the emotion of fear is a really valuable one. We'll see children who'll want to hear that ghost story over and over again because their brains are practicing how to experience that fear but not be overwhelmed with it, to actually bring down their stress response, to actually cope with it, and then at the end come through it. And it's known as predictive coding, the ability of our brains to respond to that world around us. And it's something the arts are so effective at helping us to build up.
Does it matter if it's highbrow or lowbrow, if I can put it that way, whether it's, say, a comic book versus The Odyssey?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the highbrow, lowbrow because they're terms that we've imposed as societies
Exactly.
that don't always hold sway if you take them to other contexts. So there's actually no scientific evidence that you're going to get a more valuable experience from a so-called highbrow one compared to a so-called lowbrow one. The most important thing is actually picking experiences where you have got a little bit of a framework around what you're going to experience. So you know a little bit about what to expect. So many people I know, including myself, have sometimes found like modern art galleries quite overwhelming because you don't know what you're supposed to be judging necessarily. But actually, that's because of this tension resolution thing that we've spoken about. Our happiness from the arts is based on predicting what might be about to happen and then seeing that either thwarted or resolved. And if we don't have a sense of what to expect, then we can't build up that expectation. We can't have that tension and resolution. So it's important to pick arts experiences where we've got a little bit of a frame of reference. We can push ourselves a bit, but we shouldn't feel a pressure to do something just because it's judged as being valuable by some so-called highbrow label.
There is such a debate about screen time, especially for young people and even young adults with growing and developing brains. How do you see video games, for instance, fitting into what we've been talking about in terms of creativity? I don't play them, but I've seen other people play them. Some are pretty impressive, I have to say, when it comes to navigating this world that gets created on the screen. How do you see that?
It really depends on the game, to be honest. There are some games that really bring in that creativity. You're involved in creating new worlds around you. You're building things. There are other games where you're really watching interesting stories play out, and that can be really valuable in that emotional way that we get from watching a play as well. But then there are other games where you actually feel like those creative, imaginative ingredients just aren't really there. Like, for example, they're really based on just fighting, but not actually taking you on that narrative or emotional or creative journey. And at that point, I feel like we've lost some of those core artistic ingredients. So it's not to say that it doesn't have any benefits, but it's no longer classed in that way of an arts activity where we can understand it based on the existing arts literature.
You say think of the arts like food. I mean, there's junk food, of course, and then there's, you know, healthy food.
Yes, I'm probably a little bit rude in my book because I do call screen-based arts the ultra-processed foods.
You do
of
indeed,
the arts
yes.
World for a while. I mean, the reason for this is that from the studies that we have so far, we often see that people's responses to the arts when it is through a screen-based format can be a little bit more diluted. So, for example, emotionally, people tend to have a more modest response to singing in a virtual choir compared to singing in a real-life choir with other people around them, and they don't get the social benefits. And when we look at things like the cinema, we don't see the same cognitive benefits from going to the cinema as we do from going to the live theatre. And this seems to be something to do with the screen-based nature of it that we still don't fully understand. But I think it's also just a reminder that whilst there can be those great benefits from the storylines that we watch in films or from television series, for example, it's also good to balance this with those other activities that are in real life that will help to bring those social or physical ingredients too.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Daisy Fancourt, our guest today on The Connection. And we're talking about art and health and well-being. And her book is titled Art Cure, The Science of How the Arts Save Lives. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and just a recap here, we know that a healthy diet, exercise, sleep are critical to our well-being. Now we're learning that music and dance, hobbies, going to concerts can reduce stress and depression, can strengthen memory and brain health. Our guest is award-winning scientist Daisy Fancourt, and we're discussing the healing power of the arts and her new book called Art Cure, The Science of How the Arts Saves Lives. I remember a number of years ago when everyone was kind of goo-goo gaga about something called the Mozart effect, that if you had your baby listen to Beethoven or Prokofiev or Mozart, that somehow that would increase their IQ. Was that debunked?
It's a wonderful idea, isn't it?
It sure
is. It's not stood up to scientific scrutiny. I think when these initial studies were done, a lot of them were cross-sectional, which means they'd use data at a single time point, and they'd seen if there was this correlation between the amount of music that someone had listened to and a particular outcome they'd had. But actually, that doesn't tell us that it's causal. And in fact, when there were trials that were done, they actually found that that wasn't the case. But it's not to say that there aren't benefits of music and other arts for children. It might not instantaneously raise the IQ of a baby, but actually listening to music does play a really important role, for example, in supporting language acquisition in babies. The region of the brain that's involved in learning language actually overlaps with the same region involved in music processing in babies. So singing to babies actually helps to rehearse the same functions that are going to be important in language. And trials have shown that lots of music engagement with young infants can help with supporting language acquisition, as well as the arts having a much broader range of benefits for supporting young children's mental health and development.
Let me ask you about the subtitle of your book, The Science of How the Arts Save Lives. And one could take that to mean that, you know, instead of having surgery or go to the museum or listen to music, we've been talking a lot about music, that will actually cure you of what's wrong with you. I know you're not saying that, but I just want to make sure that people know how you see the arts and medicine working together.
It's a really important point to make. And actually, in the opening pages of the book, I'm really clear that the arts are not something that I'm proposing as alternatives to really well-researched medical treatments. This is not an anti-pills approach or anything like that. And I also talk about the fact there are plenty of examples of the arts not having benefits or even causing harm. But actually, the point here is that the arts can have a really profound effect on our health, whether it's supporting us with a sense of well-being, with helping us manage mental health problems, and also supporting lots of different health conditions, from neurological disorders to cardiovascular diseases and so on. And I share examples in the story of where the arts have been the difference between life and death, whether that's actually arts experiences that have helped people who've been contemplating suicide to actually find alternative ways, that then alternative paths they can take in their lives. And even examples of how the arts have been used during medical emergencies like Ebola as a way of communicating critical health messages to ensure that people have undertaken preventative behaviors that have saved lives.
It's interesting to think about, you know, what art can do. As you say, the arts can be the difference between life and death. It can improve immune activities. Knowing that something like Ebola could, you know, it can be devastating to communities, and how, I guess, using the arts is a way to help people understand what medical messages are all about.
And this is really important in an age where actually it can be difficult to know what to trust. During Ebola, for example, in West Africa, there was a lot of misinformation and mistrust of healthcare professionals. There were concerns that Ebola wasn't real and was actually part of a conspiracy. And as a result of this, the traditional didactic ways of trying to tell people what they should be doing, like that wasn't working as an approach. But there were local artists, including a rapper, mural artists. There were locals who were writing radio plays, who actually worked together to use art as a way of telling stories in local dialects, co-produced with local communities. And through the stories, they helped to explain what Ebola was, how it was transmitted, how it could be stopped. And these arts-based approaches were much more humanizing. They built trust and rapport. They were grassroots. And this is actually one of these campaigns alone, which was led through UNICEF. It was called I Survived Ebola. And it's actually credited with changing the behaviors of 1.5 million people in West Africa.
Wow. This is sort of a weird segue, but I'm also thinking that in times of war and conflict, people will, you'll hear about orchestras that spring up in the middle of a war zone.
We see this time and time again. We're unfortunately seeing it play out in various parts of the world at the moment. We're actually in refugee camps. There are arts programs that are developing from artists who are in those camps. And actually, we're seeing that it's often in those times of greatest human challenge that we most strongly turn towards the arts. They're a way of psychologically processing trauma. They're a way of connecting us to those around us, to being able to hold on to really important identities. And I think this is a real example of why the arts are not a kind of luxury or a cherry on the cake when we're thinking about their impact on health. They're something that is really fundamental for us to be thinking about how they can be supporting us as individuals and communities.
We often think about health, you know, what's the matter with me? Why don't I feel good? You say perhaps it's better to say what matters to me as a different way to understand our health and well-being.
This, I think, is a really important framing. For example, in England, we've found that about 20% of appointments with doctors are actually not medical. They're people who are coming with challenges like loneliness or low-level mood problems, for example. And actually reframing the conversation to say, well, it's not about what is the matter, but about what matters. This can be actually, are you lonely? Do you need more social connection? Have you lost a sense of purpose? Are you looking for a way of finding meaning in your day-to-day life? Are you experiencing stress? These are all things that the arts are really well placed to support with. So we actually have doctors all across England now prescribing the arts to people. This is part of a movement known as social prescribing, which is now happening in 40 countries around the world, including in a number of different places around the US.
Well, this whole notion of longevity and health and human connection, and we can throw in the arts as well.
We absolutely can. And when we're thinking about kind of pillars of our health, we're very used to talking about diet, about exercise, about sleep and nature. And I'm arguing that actually the arts need to be considered as one of those pillars. They're not things that we routinely talk about in that way. And in fact, if you ask an American on the streets, only 1 in 20 will say they did any arts yesterday. But it's really important that we're actually raising awareness about how strong the scientific literature now is, so that people are aware that this is a simple thing they could be doing a little bit more of each day that could have some really meaningful effects on their health and well-being.
I don't know how true it is in England, but here in the States, especially when money is tight, what's the first to go in a school? It's often the arts programs.
It is. And I think this is quite illogical, actually, because for many young people at the moment, we know that there are major challenges around mental health, for example. We also know that there can be challenges around loneliness, a problem that is profoundly increasing amongst young people at the moment in many places. And there are also other issues we're facing, like what are the jobs these young people are going to do? What are the skills they're going to need? And a lot of the things that keep coming up are saying that the future skills that are going to be most important are those around creativity, compassion, resilience. And these are all the exact skills that the arts help us to build up. So it feels like they should quite obviously be part of our education. And it's quite a challenge and a problem that they're not.
You referenced longevity, and I do want to talk about the aging brain. And we certainly know that sometimes there's dementia, there's Parkinson's, there are other disabilities that can happen when you get older. How do the arts help to mitigate that?
There's increasing literature suggesting that arts engagement helps us to stay cognitively active. So it can help to build what's known as the cognitive reserve in our brain, which is our ability to compensate, to have some resilience. So even if we are starting to accumulate some of the pathological symptoms of dementia, it means we might be able to compensate for longer, to carry on leading an independent life for a lot till an older age, until those symptoms really start to show. And there are lots of activities that have been shown to support cognitive reserve, but actually art seems to be emerging as one of the important ones. Mm. For example, a number of studies, including some recent ones, have found that people who engage regularly in the arts actually have patterns of connection between regions of the brain that are vulnerable to aging. They've got stronger patterns of connection, and they actually have brains that show up as younger when we look at brain ages. And this is exciting in terms of thinking another thing very simply we could be doing each day that could be helping us to stay cognitively active and functioning for longer.
Such as, what should we do to keep our brains healthy longer?
Learning musical instruments or engaging with crafts like textiles, for example, going to cultural places like museums or galleries or shows that are giving us this kind of cognitive challenge for our brains, and particularly activities that are involving lots of different regions of our brain at once, which is what the arts are so effective at doing.
You talk about the familiarity-complexity balance, that there are things, certainly children, but I think us adults as well, will do something or perhaps watch a show over and over and over again. We know everything about it, yet we go back to it. But there's also the complexity side of that balance as well.
Giving ourselves a little bit of a challenge is really good because it keeps us engaged. And there's a particular state known as the flow state, which many people will have experienced, where you get so engrossed in something, you completely lose track of time or the world around you. And this flow state is really beneficial for our brains and also for our own mental health. And we get it particularly when we're doing activities that have got that balance between familiarity and complexity. That's when we're most likely to enter this state of flow. And in fact, a study that was undertaken in the US looked at what are the activities that are most likely to give us a state of flow. And after looking at over 200 different activities, that one that came up, number one, was arts and crafts.
Wow. Wow. So even just doodling or using a coloring book, anything related to arts and crafts or putting something
very
on paper?
Very much so. There's been a huge boom in mindful coloring books because many people appreciate that when they're doing them, they get into that state of flow. And when they're in that state of flow, it's really valuable in terms of calming our brains. It's an attention restoration activity. So it's bringing our brains back to a nice calm state rather than that typical day to day where we're bombarded with information and we're flitting around between so many things at once.
I think many people say, well, I'm not good at painting, so I'm not going to do that. Or I'm not good at playing an instrument, so I'm not going to do that. How important is it to be good at what you're doing in the arts?
It really isn't important for so many of the health benefits we're talking about. And in fact, look at children. You know, many children are not good at colouring when they're doing it. But we would never say, oh, therefore children shouldn't bother colouring. It's very much an artificial thing we've brought upon ourselves that we will enjoy doing the arts as young people. And then as soon as we become adults, we'll decide that if we're not good enough with some kind of artificial threshold, that we shouldn't be doing them anymore. And I think I would say, be a child again, like engage as a child does, enjoy colouring, enjoy making music, enjoy singing, enjoy acting things out, going to festivals or carnivals that give you those joyful, creative experiences.
What do you do?
I love playing the piano. I'm an avid reader. I really enjoy going to gigs, particularly kind of folk music nights. And I've also been getting into my mindful colouring recently with my daughters.
I like mindful colouring. It is that you do feel that flow state. Can we talk a little bit about the vagus nerve? And there's a lot of, you know, misinformation, probably a lot of hype about the nerve. But how do you see it? It's kind of the super highway in our body that connects to so much of our organs. How do you see the role of the vagus nerve in the arts?
I see this as part of our overall autonomic nervous system, which we do know that the arts can influence. So when we are listening to calming music, for example, when we are looking at calming art or reading books, it can help to reduce levels of sympathetic nervous system activity, which is what we get when we're feeling in a kind of stress state, and increase levels of parasympathetic nervous system activity. And we see that reflected in heart rate and blood pressure. But it's actually interesting, you can also engage in more invigorating arts experiences and have relaxing benefits. Many people will know that if they go for a run, it might be kind of exhausting in the moment, but actually you get that deep sense of relaxation shortly afterwards. And that's what can happen from listening to dance music or being involved, like playing in a band in a really exciting gig or performing on the stage. In the moment, you've actually got very high levels of arousal. Your heart rate and blood pressure might go up temporarily, but actually afterwards you swing back into that much calmer state. And the arts are so wonderful because they can essentially therefore relax us directly with calm experiences or give us those joyful, invigorating experiences that raise us up at first and then help us to feel more relaxed afterwards.
And how important is movement, just moving your body to experience some form of art?
Movement is really valuable, and we see this particularly for people who might have neurological disorders or neurodegenerative conditions. There is such a strong literature now emerging about the benefits of dance for people, for example, with Parkinson's disease, where it can not only play a role similar to exercise in terms of people staying functionally active, helping to slow rates of motor decline, but it can also support mental health, quality of life, social connections, meaning. I worked with a program in the UK which was using ballet for people with Parkinson's disease. Mm. And there was a man there who said to me that he'd found it really difficult doing exercise and feeling he was having to like relearn things that he'd been doing since he was a toddler. But actually doing dance was a whole new thing. It was a fresh identity. It meant that it felt like a much more joyful, non-medicalized approach to getting the physical activity that he needed.
What about, we're almost out of time here, but you tell an incredible story about magic, the importance and role of magic.
This is a beautiful project called Breathe Magic. It's for children who have cerebral palsy that's caused a one-sided paralysis on their body. And the typical treatment is hours and hours of hand therapy exercises, which children really don't want to do necessarily. But in the UK, occupational therapists teamed up with some of the world's leading magicians and turned every hand therapy exercise into a magic trick. So the young people now go to magic camps where they get those tens of hours of hand therapy exercises without even realizing it. But they also get to prepare for magic shows. It builds confidence. They're standing on a stage, making eye contact and being proud of the skill that they're showing. And it's a program that's had some wonderful trials demonstrating its efficacy. It's had neuroimaging studies showing that it even changes patterns of brain activation, and mental health studies showing the profound long-term benefits.
So magic is the kind of route in?
Very much. It's a way of turning a medicalized treatment into something that is joyful, that is humanized, that is creative, that the young people are really proud to be taking part of. And I think it's a perfect example of how bringing the medical together with the arts can create something that is so much greater and has such a profound impact.
Daisy Fancourt, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection and for writing this book. Really appreciate it.
It's been so lovely to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. And again, the book is called Art Cure, The Science of How the Arts Save Lives. She's a professor of psychobiology and epidemiology at University College London, also director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center for Arts and Health. Charlie Kyer has been our engineer. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.